Blog Talk Radio.
Hello there, ladies and gentlemen, and others. You may have guessed at this moment that I am not Sherry Rabinowitz. Sherry Rabinowitz is on vacation. She is being replaced right now by Stephen L. Sears. That is me. And I have the honor of actually interviewing a wonderful author and actually a friend of mine by the name of Sherry Rabinowitz. You see a pattern. Sherry, are you there?
I'm here.
There you are.
That was charming.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I have a second-degree black belt in charm. So, Sherry. Sherry is one of my favorite people. Sherry is an author. She is an interviewer. She has, obviously, Chatting with Sherry, which we're listening to now. And she also has Sherry's Playhouse. I invite everybody to check that out. It's an opportunity for up-and-coming artists and writers to see their work to fruition. She's enabling that. She is the author of Different is Beautiful, which is an incredibly wonderful children's book. The accolades on that book are plenty, and she's been winning awards with that book. It really is a wonderful little book. Fantasy Time Incorporated, Murder Incorporated, and actually, I hope you are incorporated now that I think about it. But Sherry, your latest book is very interesting because this is not a book of fiction. This is a memoir. And I would say an autobiography, but it really is more of a memoir. And it's called Entering My Second Half. Now, the interesting thing about this book when I read it is you didn't write this in a standard style. When I read the book, it is like talking to you. I actually hear your voice. It is not laid out as a novel. It's not laid out with a beginning, middle, and end type of story because you are talking about your life and your second mm-hmm. half, and implying that you're entering your second half also means that in the three-act structure, you have not completed your third act just yet. You're a work in progress. And
okay.
Why did you pick that particular style? What was that a conscious decision on your point to actually make it more conversational and much more like somebody would be just having lunch with you and you would just be talking? Was that a conscious choice?
No, it was just the way it kind of poured out of my head. As you said, I haven't really entered the senior years yet. I wanted to write in a way that is more just talking about my life up to this point. Actually, not even this point. It's pretty much 5-10 years before this point that I end it. But it wasn't a conscious thing. It was more of, well, this is the way it's going to work because it's the easiest way for me to structure it.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's it does. It does. Well, of course, after reading it, it definitely makes sense. Now, I'm going to, as we go through this interview, I'm going to bring up some of the things that are in the book. I realize that if I were to just say, so, you know, tell me about your life, you would probably just pick up the book and read it to me. there's a lot of questions that I have about certain things you mentioned in the book. But the first one I think most people would ask is why? Why does this book exist? When people write memoirs, you know, a lot of people turn a very critical eye toward that because they look at it as either somebody's attempt at ego or that somebody is trying to write a message or that somebody has experiences that they think can be of value to other people. Now, I know you personally. I know ego and arrogance are two words that aren't even really in your vocabulary. For people who have not had the honor of actually talking with Sherry personally in a social setting, she is one of the most sweetest, humblest people you're going to meet. So I'm going to eliminate the ego aspect right there. But you have a fascinating upbringing. But why did you decide to actually put this down into a form where people could, where you could share it with people? What was your point in doing that?
It was, well, at first it was just a personal thing. It was, I was reaching 50. I was scared. I had never worried about age, ever. I always looked younger than I am. I always felt younger than I was. So I never really worried about getting older. And for some reason, 50 was like hitting a brick wall. I was coming into a panic, and it was months before my birthday when I was feeling this. So I thought, psychologically, I need to do something. So I did the old thing of taking a piece of paper and writing down my good things that happened in my life and the bad things that happened in my life. And I looked at it and I went, you know what? I had a really interesting life. Maybe I'll write it down and maybe it would help people. That's the catharsis. I mean, really, it's very cathartic to write it.
Well, I think there's a lot of things that actually come out of this book. First of all, people should understand that Sherry's life was, this will sound very strange because she's so not like this. Sherry's life was in showbiz. She's not a showbiz person, but because of her family, because of her curiosity, her passions, she got involved with a lot of people in show business. And I mean, when I was reading the book, I was kind of like, wow, you actually met that person, you had a conversation with that person remembered you from an incident that you'd had before. And what I also thought was interesting is that you mentioned several people whom, in fact, I have had interactions with, but I actually have had 30 years of concentrated effort in this business. You met these people before you were like 18. So your goldfish bowl is a lot different than other people's goldfish bowl.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things was, my dad's going to come up a lot in this conversation. My dad was the friendliest guy in the world. I mean, he was a lot like you. He'd turn around and just start talking to anybody. And my dad was in this bowling group in Granada Hills, and Granada Hills, a lot of actors live up there. And he became friends with all these people, and they were movers and shakers in the business. And so I kind of grew up around these people and continually crossed paths with other people that were famous because they were neighbors or because they were friends of one of my girlfriends or people that were parents of people that I went to school with. It wasn't ever conscious. I never chased after anybody. It was more like just, oh, wow, hi. just part of my life. And really, when I was looking back, I was like, whoa, I forgot about that. It kind of poured out of my head as I was writing the story.
Well, that's one of the interesting things about it is that you have a mention here of sharing classes with Valerie Bertinelli, who a lot of boomers certainly will remember. A lot of the younger people will have to look up Valerie Bertinelli, but she was a star TV actress, very, very popular. And also, at the same time, John Elway. So football fans will understand who John Elway is. And these were people that you just looked at as being, oh, you know, those are the kids down the hall, or, you know, I'm sharing a classroom with that particular person. But it's those kinds of names that just keep popping up.
Yeah. Valerie and I took a bicycle class together. This is sort of funny. She was on hiatus, and we were taking a bicycle class, and she used to come in the library a lot, and I worked in the library, so I saw her often. And John was in my history class, and I was also very good friends with his sister, Jana, so I actually knew him a lot better than I knew Valerie, because I used to go to her house. He was there. I wasn't like buddies, but everybody in my school knew everybody else, even though it was a big, huge class. He was part of the jock group, but he was highly intelligent. I mean, he was a baseball player and a football player. He was our valedictorian. It was hard not to know John.
Yeah.
But he was the nicest, most friendliest, most down-to-earth person. He had no, when I knew him, there was no ego there, none. It's just,
wow.
This is what I do.
Well, people certainly remember that he went on to
the rest of
them. Well, see, but that's an interesting thing that most people, we have kind of tunnel vision. The people that we grow up with are our friends or people that we just casually knew. So, you know, it's not until you look back in retrospect and realize, oh, that person, you know, went to this, you know, that person went here. I mean, for all you know, even though on your book you actually said that you had not had a chance to say hi to Val, you actually say it in your book to Valerie. Who's to say that Valerie Bertinelli hasn't been listening to some of your chatting with Sherry's and saying, wow, I actually knew her back then.
Yeah. Yeah. And my mom tried to say, Sherry, send her a note, because we actually went to see Hot in Cleveland. And I said, no, she's not going to remember me in years. So at the end of my little section where I talked about her, I said, hi, Val.
Yeah, see? And it was very, very cute. And that's very you. That's, like I said, this thing doesn't read like it's a novel. It's, I can actually hear your voice when you said that. I mean, you had neighbors like, Russell Johnson, who was in Gilligan's Island. Who else did you mention? Louis Jourdan, he was in your neighborhood, right?
Yeah, he lived near us, not in my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
He lived, I think he lived in Porter Ranch. I lived in Granada Hills.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you guys, oh, I see. Yeah, I have a little note here that you guys went to the same children's party places, whatever
yeah.
The Chuck E. Cheese of the time was.
It was called Genie Land. It was such a fun place.
Genie Land. Oh, wow. So that was like the I Dream of Genie time.
Yeah, it was really fun. Everybody went there. In fact, my brother and I ran into Leon Merriweather at the same Comic-Con where I saw you. And I brought it up because my mom said that she was there for her daughter, and her daughter was sitting next to her, and she said, oh, I love Genie Land. I go, yeah, I know, so did I. And we started talking about Genie Land while my brother was getting his autograph.
That's funny. That is very funny.
Yeah.
Well, let's see here.
Very popular.
Yeah. Well, like I said, a lot of people, they don't have that experience. And your book actually has so many great stories of different people that the names, I mean, you mentioned Fess Parker, obviously, in your neighborhood. You have a great story about James Garner that I'm going to have you tell later on. I love James Garner. Most people do, but I want you to tell that story in a minute. But hold on that for a second. The other thing I get from your book is that there was a really tight sense of family. I mean, you had wonderful parents.
Yes.
I'm just going to go right out on a limb and tell you that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm very blessed by that as well. I had absolutely incredibly wonderful parents, and parents mold so much of who we are. Talk, if you can, for a moment about them, just a little bit, because especially your father. I mean, not outweighing your mother, but you mentioned your father several times in this book, and you also just previously said that he was a very open, easygoing guy. But he's also very protective. That comes out in the book. He was very, very protective of his family.
Oh, very. He was a tiger. My dad was from Brooklyn, and you would never know. He had no accent, highly intelligent, extremely well-read. But when he was mad, the Brooklyn would come out. He was extraordinarily protective of us. He was a great dad. He was hands-on dad, way ahead of his time. He did diaper changing. He loved to make us Sunday breakfast. He was a rock of our family. We miss him dearly. He was funny. He graduated high school. He went to 1 year of college, but he really couldn't afford to get the education he wanted, and yet he was the smartest man I have ever met. And I mean, and I've met a lot of really very intelligent people. He read anything and everything he could get his hands on. He was he was a wonderful guy, and he was a tiger when it came to me and my brother. He would protect us. For instance, when I wanted to be an actress and I went on an audition, he wouldn't let me go by myself. He went with me. He knew about the casting couch. He knew about the cons. My mom and dad wanted to put me into acting when I was a baby in the commercials, and they got conned. And so he was extremely protective of me for when I went on auditions. He protected me from some prejudice that I ran into later. He was protective of both me and my brother. He was protective of my mom, too. And it was funny because one thing my mom talks about my dad was most husbands, apparently, they don't like their wives to spend money. My dad encouraged my mother to spend money more than she wanted him to. Honey, why don't you get your hair done? Honey, why don't you get a new outfit? He was really loving. He was an amazing guy. So lucky.
Well, it comes across that way. It comes across that way. The very loving family. Your dad is just kind of like comes off as being that warm and affable kind of guy that, you know, probably was the kind of guy who would be at a party and would naturally attract people around him. But the protective attitude was, you showed it in the book. There was an incident with a snowball fight.
Yeah.
Now, that was, and I think that's actually very relevant these days. But this was a bullying that happened. And, I mean, you take it, you tell the story. Go ahead and tell that story, because I think it illustrates your family bond, but also illustrates a lot of the difficulty you had growing up.
Yeah, it was actually a turning point in my life. I had a rather idyllic life until that period. We moved to Ohio. I was about 9. And my parents wanted us to acclimate, so we moved in the summertime, and we made really good friends with everybody on our block. There was no problems. Everybody got along great. And so when we started school, we weren't expecting any problems. Around Christmas time for Hanukkah, my parents got me a bicycle, brand new, beautiful bike, pink, which is my favorite color, with pretty basket. And I had my books in the basket. I was riding home from school. And these boys came running up and started throwing snowballs at me, which at first I didn't think was a big deal. But then it hit my shoulder and there was a rock in it. And they started calling me a Christ killer, which I grew up in California. I had never heard the term before. I had never been, nobody had ever said anything like that to me. I had no idea what they meant. And other terrible things, which I won't say. And well, I left my brand new bike, which actually the wheel got broken because of the rocks that hit it, and ran home. So in tears, in a panic, frantic. And my mother didn't understand because I was talking gibberish because I was so upset. When she got me calmed down enough, she got really crazed, and she called my dad at work. At that time, my father was an executive for a big company in Ohio, and he was the vice president in sales marketing. So for him to leave work like he did was a big deal, but he did. He was very upset. When he went to his boss, he said, "What kind of place is this? What kind of place would do this to a child?" And the guy, who was also his friend, said, "Sit down, let me tell you about this place." And he said, "When we moved here, we were looking for a church, a Catholic church. And we went into the church that was closest to our home, and they took one look at our Irish red hair and our freckled face, and they said, 'You're in the wrong place. You have to go to the one over on the other street.'" It turned out that they had everything separated. There was the Italian Catholic Church, the Irish Catholic Church, the Lithuanian people. I mean, everybody was separated. The Jews were in a different area from the Catholics, Protestants. I mean, it was, to me, the strangest thing I'd ever heard in my life, and same for my parents. So he really gave it to the principal of my school that this happened to me. And the principal sent out this notice that still makes me laugh. We're going to have a discussion about prejudice in the school. We're going to have a white person, a black person, and a Jewish person. And my father looked at the notice and said, well, what is the Jewish person purple? And that was the mentality of the time. But he was a tiger. He tore into anybody. Watching him, I mean, I had a few times when he came to my rescue. He was the hero of my life.
Yeah, but he was also very, very forward-thinking because even though the school thought they were correcting it by saying, you know, we're going to have a seminar where we're going to bring in different people, I understand that for familiarity purposes, but your father also saw the fact that you are now introducing them as different.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that comes across in several places in the book.
Yeah. He didn't like that. He was extremely forward thinking. He believed in he wanted a universal government. He was a big science fiction nut. My dad actually met Albert Einstein. That's not in the book. This is about him, not me. But my dad, when he was the age that this happened, met Albert Einstein at the New York Public Library. He met all the leaders of the different science fiction clubs. My dad was the president of his for Lincoln High School. And he met Albert Einstein. I mean, my dad was always a sci-fi person and a science person. And so he knew a lot, but he wasn't like arrogant about it. It was amazing.
Well, he sounds like he's amazing. I like to just casually throw out, oh, by the way, not in the book, he met Albert Einstein. But let's get back to you, because obviously your parents and your family and everything made you who you are. But the focus of this book and the focus of your book is about you. Now, you're very upfront in your book about a lot of the things that have created crises in your own particular self-image, for example.
Yeah.
People who would tease you, questions you had about yourself. And you had some very, you know, and by the way, this harkens back also to your book, Different is Beautiful, because the thing about that children's book is that it does say that you are a unique person. Stop accepting what other people say. You know, listen, hear, but don't let them define you. And that comes across in your book. You actually said a wonderful little quote here. You said, magazines are full of lies. And I think that's true. I think that magazines hold up a mirror that we want to aspire to, but at the same time, they tell us not to accept who we are. And I think a lot of your book has been you dealing with coming to terms with that, accepting who you are and being proud of that.
Yep. It's still a struggle for me. I mean, that incident in Ohio made me question people, be aloof. Even though I'm a friendly person, I'm not aloof, but I stand back a little bit. Yeah, exactly. It's scary to me to be too trusting too fast because I've been hurt. And that's something I fight all the time.
And the thing that I think people can identify with is that everybody has that type of feeling in the background or in the foreground, that they're afraid to let people in. Something hurts them. Something in their past has made them put up walls. But that still is a uniqueness because we all have our particular things and particular reasons for it and why we react to it. You actually just come right out and talk about it. But at the same time, when you're talking about how people made fun of you for different reasons, there's also a part of you that is just so, even even from being a child, was so curious about the world and so passionate about living that you may have ducked your head a little bit, but you kept charging forward. I mean, a lot of people who know you from Chatting Sherry or know you personally would never guess all the acting that you did.
Yeah.
For somebody who's supposed to be very shy and hiding behind a book cover, you were doing performance. You were not just like, oh, I was, you know, they asked me to do, you know, something in the background. You were seeking these out. You were going for these particular roles. You did a lot of acting.
Yeah, passionately. That was my goal. I wanted to be a writer and I wanted to be an actress. Those were my goals. I pursued it. From the time my dad called me a shy little actress, he got me into my first acting class outside of school. It was a little theater called Burbank Little Theater. And when my mom and my dad went to see a play there and then talked to one of the directors and asked about, do you guys have acting classes? And they said, yes. Yeah. So they took me and my brother to it. And at the intermission, he saw the director he had talked to, and he said, come on, Sherry, let's talk to him. And I said, no, he's busy. He's directing. He goes, come on. He basically dragged me over. And he says, I want you to meet my shy little actress. I mean, that was my dad. But once I got there and I got comfortable, I was gung-ho. I enjoyed it. I was taking classes there at the same time as taking classes in school. I was auditioning for plays. I auditioned for a play there. I got into a play there. It was my first play outside of school. It was called Damn Yankees. I auditioned for TV shows. I didn't have anybody to help me. You know, I knew all these people.
Yeah.
I didn't have like that. Oh, well, let me help you get into the show business. It was just me. I was digging through drama log, going to audition. It was a passion.
Well,
so
well,
anything I got, I earned.
Well, that is because you did have a passion for it. You weren't looking for, you know, Academy Awards.
No.
You were looking to fulfill things. Now, I will say that, and you know, I will just go ahead and take a stab at this, play pop psychologist for a moment. Because you are, at your core, a very shy person, these acting and writing, in general, are great ways for shy people to put up masks and dance behind them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
When you played characters, I imagine that shy little girl was still there, but now you had an excuse to explode and actually fulfill the passion you had for performance and be people openly and very proudly.
It was that. It was also my creative need. I needed to do it. I had so many characters in my head from watching movies and reading books because I was obsessed with both and TV shows that I needed to get out there. I needed to act. It was part of me. It didn't matter if I was in a little theater group or if I was working on a TV set or if I was working on newsletters for somebody that is well known. I didn't care. I wanted to create. I wanted to pursue it. It was my passion. It was my grand desire. So yeah.
And not only that, obviously going back to your family again, they were very proud of you. I mean, my parents were very proud of me when I was doing acting. My mother was my biggest fan, and they showed up at every performance I ever did. However, my family never did actually perform with me in a play. You actually got your entire family to be in a play with you. That has to have been a really weird experience.
Yeah, it was. It was fun, but it was weird. Okay, I auditioned for Damn Yankees. I got a part, and my dad was taking me because I was 15 going on 16, so I hadn't reached even, I couldn't drive yet, and so my dad took me to all the interviews, all the rehearsals and everything, and toward the end, one of the actors who's also a magician at Magic Castle, which was the first time I ever got to go to Magic Castle, was because of him. He got a gig. He got a magic gig. So he left and he goes, Lou, I want you, that's my dad's name, Lou. Lou, I want you to do it. And then I haven't been in a play since I played Mordecai in a play. I was great. He goes, what are you talking about? Me do it. I'm not an actor. Sherry's the actor. He goes, Lou, it's easy. You're playing the baseball commissioner. You can do it. So he talked to the director, Wayne, and he said, I think Lou can do it. And my dad had a great presence, and he had a great voice. I mean, he had a really wonderful voice. He wanted to be a radio announcer when he was a kid. And so Wayne goes, yeah, Lou would be great. So Dad was nervous as heck, and he decided, well, I'm going to paste the lines on the desk. Would that be okay? And they said, sure. And so he had to go to all the performances, and they needed someone to help backstage. My brother had been working out with weights for about a year, and he actually was starting to get a really good build. And so he worked backstage as an assistant backstage. My mother handed out the programs, and she doesn't want to ever see another performance of Damn Yankees for the rest of her life. She actually won't even watch the Gwen Vernon version of it. Because she saw all the performances of it.
So you had your own little production group there. That was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's stories like that that make your book really delightful. And there's so much here. I know we don't have a lot more time to. Don't worry, folks. We're not going away for another like 13 minutes. At least that's what my clock is telling me. But I mean, aside from your family. And the fact that you grew up in that goldfish bowl with all these different celebrities, the really interesting thing, I've mentioned this before, is your self-examination, is what you have learned about yourself and what you've learned from life. And you've done a lot of things that people would not assume, you know, and without going off too much on this story, because they can read it in the book, you glossed over this, actually, but you wrote, directed, starred in your own production, called It's a Family Affair. So you've done everything, not because you were required to, but because you wanted to. You had this forward momentum. But at the same time, you were still looking at, I don't know how to put this, but you still had an eye that was outside of you, looking back at yourself. As I said earlier, you came to the realization that magazines are full of lies, which I think was incredibly insightful. But you balance that out by saying that what this book is about is very simply put. You said this, the quest to find the best me that I can be.
Yep, that's it. It sounds so simple, but it's not. It's the hardest journey to take is to just find your authentic self. And like I said, I still struggle with it. I'm preaching to the choir. I'm part of the choir. I have not solved the problem. I just think that the biggest, most important thing to do is try to find where you are going, who you are, and try to be as honest with yourself as you can. And in today's society, everybody wants to be a star. Everybody wants to be a reality star. Everybody wants to be the center of their life. I understand that. I had that impetus for a long, long, long time. But really, now all I want to do is just be me, just really be honestly who I am. And that's why another reason why I wrote the book is to find out who I was. That sounds like I got lost or something.
Anybody who's heard me lecture or speak at a class with writers or actors or whatever, I ask people what their goals are, and I hear a variety of things. I want to win awards, or I want to create a series, or I want to be, I want to be the star of my own movie, whatever. And I tell them they're all wrong. That's not really their goal. Their goal is just basically to be happy. That is the simplest thing. Being happy is your goal. But I also say what makes most people miserable is trying to figure out what will do that.
Yeah.
So that's what you very, in a much more concise way, that's what you meant. You're on a quest to find the best you that you can possibly be, which means that you are an evolving creature. You are not somebody who is going to sit there and say, okay, I'm happy where I am. Now, when you take that in context with everything else you've written, now it makes sense. Yes, you can be extremely shy. You can be somewhat fearful about how people might perceive you. You can be a little cautious about the friends that you have. But as long as you're on the quest to find the best you that you can be, you will always be moving forward. I think that's what comes across in your book. It's one of the things that, one of the little delightful subliminal messages that kind of hit me about two-thirds of the way through.
That's nice. I'm glad. I'm glad that came across. You never know what people are going to pick up when they're reading something. And since this isn't fiction, it's my life, it was scary to do it. I had never written fiction other than magazine articles and stuff like that. So I wasn't really sure if I even could do it, that you actually saw that. And even though you know me and you saw that, that's really nice.
There's a lot in this book that I did not know. There's a lot in this book I did not know about you. And by the way, anybody who wants to read the book should understand it's going to take you probably a chapter to get into Sherry's rhythm. Do not expect to read this like you're going to read a regular biography. This is Sherry's stream of thought. You can actually hear her thinking. And I will tell you that the first few pages, it's a little uncomfortable getting into it. And once you're into it and you realize, oh, I'm having a conversation with Sherry, it just kind of flows. And there are so many little delightful things. And I wish we had time for all of them, but I want to get to the James Garner story. Because I love James Garner, star of the Rockford Files. And since I started out with Stephen J. Cannell, and Stephen Cannell, of course, co-created the Rockford Files and worked with James Garner. Okay. Tell this story. You're working at Universal Studios, which, by the way, I did too. We have a lot in common.
Yep.
Pick it up from there. You told the story really well in the book, but pick it up from there.
Okay. I was working on the tour. I worked in an area that was the parking lot. It was the toll booth. And our responsibility wasn't just the parking lot. We also were responsible for gates and to direct traffic and direct people where they're going. I was very small. I had to direct buses, which was hilarious. So one of my jobs was to guard a area that basically now has the parking structure on it. But at the time, it was a dirt road. One road went down to the studio. The other road went out of the tour toward where the freeway is. And it was all that was there was a chain link fence, and that was it. It was dirt, chain link fence, mountains, and the freeway. There's nothing there. And so they drove me out there. They had a little table, a little chair, an umbrella. I had my water and my book, and I'm guarding the gate. And in my imagination, this was in the 70s, so I just seen this movie about the Black Dahlia, and Lucy Arnaz did it, and all I could think of was they tried to kill me.
Yeah, the Black Dahlia was till to this day, an unsolved murder that occurred in Hollywood. I won't go into details,
right,
but go ahead with your story.
Okay. So the actors, writers, directors, producers, everybody, the studio is humongous. So the way they got around is on golf carts. And they used to whiz by us all the time. It wasn't a big deal. We saw people all the time. And one day, so I'm sitting there guarding the gate, ha, 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 and this golf cart came up, and it was James Garner. And he said, "What the hell are you doing there?" And I said, "I'm guarding the gate." And he said, "You're guarding the gate? Do you have a car? You're all by yourself? What the hell?" And I said, "Well, yeah." He said, "Get in here." And I'm like, he said, "Just get in here." And to me, I'm like, "Well, he's Rockford. He's Maverick. Yes, sir." And I got my book and my water, and I got in there. And we're driving to the toll booth, and we're just chatting, and I'm telling him about school, and he's telling me about his kids, and we're having a nice conversation. And he parks at the toll booth, and he says, "Wait here." And I looked at him, and he goes, "You're not in trouble. Just wait here." So he went into the toll booth, and I could hear him. It's a glass booth, and people came up, and they give you, at that time, the toll was a dollar. You give your dollar, they give you a pamphlet, and you're off. He was screaming at poor guy. I mean, really, how dare you leave that child up there all by yourself with no car, no communication, and how? And she could, anything could have happened to her. And he goes, "I want her never to be there again. I don't want anybody to be there again. I don't care without any transportation or communication, ever." And he was my friend too. And he's like, "Okay, yes, sir." And he came out, and I'm looking like a scared rabbit. And he comes up, "You're not in trouble. You're not in trouble. You're fine. Just go in there. You're fine." And I go, "Okay." I went, and after I said goodbye, charmed itself. He said goodbye, and he went off in his golf cart. And I went in there like I was going to my death. He took that, "We were not in trouble. Congratulations. You're getting a promotion." I go, "What?" He goes, "I'll talk to them. We're going to move you up to crowd control." And I said, "What?" He goes, "It's the only way to keep you from having to do that. It's part of our area. You have to do it. And you're moving up to crowd control." And he was my friend. He became one of the teamsters who rode the trams and stuff. And he said, "Don't worry, you're fine. You're not in trouble. I still love you. You're fine." And that's the story. He's my hero.
Wow.
And
see, that's a great story. Because, I mean, James Garner was known for being very, very forceful, but not in a bad way. Everybody who worked with him, unless you were a jerk, Garner was known for taking up the cause of people. I have a couple of friends who had run-ins with him where he acted like a total non-star. He would just come out and say, "This is BS. This needs to be done. This person is being inconvenienced, and I'm not going to put up with it." So when I read that story, that you were one of those people, I just imagined you sitting there all by yourself on some chair with a bottle of water and a book, and then just this little golf cart comes up, and there's Maverick. There's Rockford. And he's like, "What are you doing here?" Now, of course, the other story, which we don't have time for, but I'll put a little hint here, is that very few people can say that they ever had Frank Sinatra tell you, "You should run off now because your dad is waiting for you."
Yeah, he was really nice. He said, because I was telling him that I was working, and the place where we changed was right near where the amphitheater was. And so you had to cross the amphitheater to get to the parking lot to my dad would be meeting me and picking me up. And so I heard Frank Sinatra singing, so I stopped. And I was talking to the guy that was there, and we were having a nice talk, and Frank came over, and the guy introduced me, and we had a nice, and then he said, "Well, where are you going?" I go, "Oh, my dad's waiting for you." He says, "What are you doing standing here? Go. Your father's waiting for you. What kind of stupid girl? Go."
That's
sweet.
Hysterical. Well, Sherry, we have, we're coming down here to our last minute. And I want to tell you that I know that we chatted just before we came on the air, and you were like, "I hate talking about myself. I just, I'm so nervous about this. I'm so shy." And, you know, what I said to you is I said, "You know, it's just you and me talking." I have been honored to know Sherry for quite a while. We kind of met, I think, through a Xena connection, because Sherry also started out in fan fiction and got a lot of her work became very popular. That led to her being an author. So I actually realized a lot about you by reading this book, and we will now have a much more substantial conversation the next time we sit down. Many of the things you mentioned in there, I kind of went, "Oh, my goodness." So, and I will just say very quickly, you apparently pursued anthropology at one point, and anthropology is actually one of my favorite areas. So you and I are going to have an extremely intense discussion about how the study of anthropology has helped your writing. But
we'll
leave it there because our time is almost up. So hopefully Sherry will be back from vacation, but I want to say how much I appreciate Sherry for being on the show. Thank you very much, Sherry.
Thank you.